Good afternoon, and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we're live from 2 to 3 in the afternoon Pacific time for you to call in if you have questions about the Bible or about the Christian faith. And also, if you have differences of opinion from the host, you can always feel free to call in and talk about those. The number is 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. Our first caller today is Sandy, calling from San Jose, California. Sandy, welcome to the Narrow Path. Good to hear from you.
Hi, Steve. How are you doing?
All right.
Hey, I got two questions. One, I'm hoping for kind of a shorter response because I think the second one will be a little more meaty. But the first one is, in the word mountain, when used in the Bible, like in Psalms 114:4, or Job 9:5, it seems to be something more than just a mountain, and I'm trying to think, does that imply something? What is it implying? I don't fully get it.
I'm not looking at the passages. Could you read one of those passages to me?
I don't have them in front of me either. If you go to Psalm 114:4, do you have a Bible in front of you?
Psalm 114.
Verse 4.
And verse 4. Okay.
Yeah.
One moment here.
Take your time.
Okay, well, it says, the mountains skip like rams, the little hills like lambs. What ails you, O sea, that you fled?
Right, so a mountain doesn't skip. So what does that mean?
This is poetry, of course, and it's talking about when God brought Israel out of Egypt, how that, you know, God did amazing, miraculous things. And it's using the poetic, we could say hyperbole or poetic license, basically talking about it as if all nature, you know, behaved abnormally. Well, what did happen is the sea opened up and made a way through for the children of Israel. But they're using images of nature acting abnormally to, I guess, to make parallels to how miraculous it was. Certainly it is not saying that the hills and the mountains skipped like rams. But see, the next line says, what ails you, O sea, that you fled? O Jordan, that you turned back. O mountains, that you skipped like rams. O little hills, like lambs. It's talking about the sea, you know, pulling back. And I don't really know what the, you know, if why they speak here of the mountains skipping like rams. But I think it's just another embellishment on the way that nature was made to act differently than normal. And I think that's just what he's doing there. But it's a difficult poetic line. The other one was in Job, you said?
Job 9:5.
Okay. In Job 9, verse 5, it says, one moment here.
Take your time.
I've got to look it up.
You don't have this all memorized, every verse on your head?
Not in the poetry books, not really.
Teasing you.
Chapter 9, verse 5 says, he removes mountains and they do not know. He overturns them in his anger. He shakes the earth out of its place, its pillars tremble. I think it's just basically, again, using hyperbole of all the things that God can do. He's probably actually talking about earthquakes in that particular case. But Job is essentially listing all the things beyond man's comprehension that God can do. And again, he's using poetry here. He's being a little bit exaggerated, but he talks about how God moves mountains.
It's like kind of like the heavens declare the glory of God, and they, you know, they pour forth speech. That's hyperbole. Okay.
Yeah, the poetry books of the Hebrews often talk about natural phenomena behaving in an unnatural way.
Got it. Okay. Yeah. So here's my meteor kind of question. Yesterday on the radio, one of the first callers talked about Jesus fulfilling the law, and you know, where does the Old Testament come in, the New Testament laws, and I think your answer was great. I really liked it, how Jesus fulfilled the law, just like an adolescent or a child becomes a man, right?
Right.
But
so the law comes to its maturity.
Right. Right. But here's one of the issues I see, and not with you. It's really more Christendom today. If you ask some people, you know, what is it, you know, what do you need to do to follow Jesus? They'll say, well, just love him, you know, love God and, you know, treat your neighbors yourself, you know. Go, well, what does that mean? Well, it just means love God, you know. And to me, it's almost nebulous, and I get that We're supposed to be led by the Spirit, okay? But still, I think we need rules to work within, and I know it's not a legalistic rules. An example would be my kids. They love me, okay? They love me. They're not going to swear at me. There's a rule there,
right?
If they love me, they'll clean their bedrooms when I ask them to. You know, there's certain rules we set down. I feel like within Christianity today, it's sort of this, whatever you feel led to do, go do it. And I think that the Ten Commandments aren't rules to follow, but if we're walking in the Spirit, we should be fulfilling them. So an example would be, you know, like I decided I'm going to, you know, steal. I feel the Lord called me to take this from someone. I know that's being a hyperbole too, but if someone's stealing, you know, they're murdering, they're not talking to their parents, they never have fellowship with the saints, I'd question their salvation. Not that I know it, but so my I don't know if it's a question or comment is, I don't think we have enough rules today. I mean, again, not legalistically. So when we say the Ten Commandments, you know, it's Old Testament, I don't think any of those we should be breaking today. So I wanted to get your, again, this isn't against something you said. I just feel this lack of people in Christianity knowing what to do. One thing, side note, is, you know, the Mormons, and I don't agree with their doctrine, you know, but when there was a big earthquake in Mexico several years ago, they pulled a button, pushed a button, and, I mean, millions of dollars went into Mexico, and Mormons tithe, or for lack of a better word, they give money to the church, you know? So I don't feel like we have enough rules, and I feel like we need more of them. Get your opinion on that.
Well, I don't know if I like the word rules as much as just the commands of God.
Commands, okay.
You know, and when I think of the commands of God that we have to obey, I'm not thinking primarily of the Ten Commandments as much as the commandments of Christ, and the commandments of Christ are going to be in line with the Ten Commandments for the most part. I don't think Jesus ever gave any commands about keeping the Sabbath, but the other commands, I think, are pretty much found in the teaching of Jesus and more besides. I believe that what is necessary for Christians is to have Jesus be their Lord. And if Jesus is their Lord, then they consider that his commands are their rule of life, and therefore they seek to live by them. And so I don't know if, you know, I don't know that I want to see religions impose more rules. I'd like to see Christians become more truly disciples of Jesus so that what he said becomes the rule of their life.
Well, and I think we're on the same page here, and I agree with you. One is being led by the Spirit, one is a bunch of rules. But even as we and I have talked before, hearing God's voice in very specific situations is difficult. And for people out there that aren't meditating in the Word every day and reading the Word today, for me to say to someone, you know, if you're breaking more of the Ten Commandments than you are fulfilling them, or at least keeping them, there's got to be some questions around your salvation.
I mean, that's a fact.
Is that fair to say?
Well, sure. I mean, if you're breaking the Ten Commandments without repentance?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Oh, yeah. For sure. I mean, if a person doesn't keep the commands of God, they don't love God. The Bible said this is the love of God, that we keep his commandments, and his commandments are not grievous.
And here's where I think my nit is. Maybe, and this is just a small piece here, but I think, and I get when you say we need to live out what Jesus is saying, but a lot of quote-unquote Christians, you know, haven't read the Bible a lot. And I think it's good to go to someone and say, hey, you know, at least keep the Ten Commandments in your heart, you know. And if you're doing those, you're at least in the right direction. So I, you know, again, I don't know if that's exactly what we're saying here, but I think it needs to be said because, again, too often people will say, love Jesus and do what you want. Well, what does that mean, you know? So anyway, didn't want to jump too much on that. Are we on the same page, you think, or not really?
I think we need to love Jesus and do what he wants. I'm a little reluctant to tell people keep the Ten Commandments because a lot of people will think that that's how they please God is by keeping
right.
The Ten Commandments. You know, we please God by having a submitted relationship to Jesus Christ, in which we have every intention and dedication to keep his commandments.
Right.
And whatever he says to do is what we consider to be our obligation. I think that if people had that mentality, then there would be even better Christianity than if we just had people trying to keep the Ten Commandments.
No, and I think we're on the same page. So when we say Jesus came to fulfill the law, he didn't abolish it, but through his grace, you know, we also fulfill it. So, okay, I think we're on the same page. I just wanted to put that out there. So, always appreciate it, Steve. Thanks for all the work you're doing. By the way, I'm about halfway through the Isaiah which I'll be finishing here, you know, hopefully soon, because we're doing it in BSF. The part, I just want to say, the part of the middle where it's a transition between the old covenant and new covenant, that is just beautiful stuff. I was just blown away by it. Just beautiful stuff. So thanks for helping.
Beautiful book.
Oh, it's just gorgeous. I wish I knew Hebrew to really understand it even better.
Yeah.
I'm really enjoying it. So thanks for your help on that as well. Okay?
Okay, Sandy. God bless you.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye now. All right. Let's talk to George from Salinas, California next. George, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hello, Steve.
Hi.
Hey, how's it going? I wanted to ask you a question, Steve. I wanted to know your opinion on borderline personality and bipolar disorder. You know, I have a loved one, and we're struggling with you know, those disorders, and I just wanted to know what you think. I wanted to know your thoughts on because I have done some research. There's a website called Wings as Eagles, and you know, it's about I think he's a pastor. He's a pastor now, but he shares his testimony on his relationship between him and his wife, and he shares that his wife, you know, this is on the website, you know, has this disorder, but he believes, you know, he writes in his website about his opinion on how these things are not like a that it's a spiritual thing.
He doesn't think it's biological.
I'm sorry?
He doesn't think it's biological or physiological.
I think he does mention, he touches on that, but I think he also, he emphasizes that it's like from maybe a traumatic experience, like abuse as a child, and from there, you know, that's like an open door for the enemy to just torture or harass that person. But I guess my struggle, you know, I wanted to know your thoughts on that, on what you think it is. The pastor there emphasizes, you know, that person needs deliverance, you know, because without deliverance, you know, then that person won't be able to forgive or you know, to grow in their Christian walk. Or you know, but I wanted to know your opinion also on another thing. What about as a Christian, if you're married to somebody who, when you were courting or dating, they acknowledged, you know, they were diagnosed, you know, with bipolar disorder, and they would beg you to come back and forgive them because of their outburst, and they didn't, you know, they weren't on medication, but now as a Christian, you know, I went to counseling to educate myself because I thought I was going crazy at times, and I grew up, you know, as a juvenile, I grew up around the atmosphere of using, you know, so as, you know, as time went on, well, I married this person because, you know, we engaged in, and I'm not going to say names for the purpose of confidentiality because I love this person. And I just hope for a miracle. But you know, I married this person because we gave in to sexual immorality, and then you know, I said, well, you know, that one mistake doesn't have to lead to another. And this person said, well, if you don't marry me, forget about the child and forget about me. And the thing is, yeah, so I did it. I'm very naive and very foolish. You know, I realized myself. You know, but the thing is, you know, the people that have this type of disorder, sometimes they disassociate from reality, and it's either black or white. You're either, they put you on a pedestal one moment, and the next you're the scum of the earth, and they shut you out. That's called splitting. And it's, brothers have told me, you know, is she even a believer? You know, because she may walk the walk, but in reality, does she have Christ in her heart? Because she'll, you know, profess.
Okay, so you brought a lot of things up here.
Yeah,
and I can tell you're going through a lot with your marriage, and I wish I knew more than I do about this very thing. I also suffered in a marriage with a wife who had problems like you described.
Yeah,
and there were people who said she had borderline disorder. There's certainly people who say she's bipolar. There's others in her family who have been diagnosed as bipolar. So, you know, I wish I knew more about those particular things.
Yes.
I would say that God has given us all things that are necessary for life and godliness, and that if we learn how to walk in the Spirit, the Bible says that we will have self-control and we'll have the fruit of the Spirit. And I don't believe that I don't believe that we ever have an excuse for behaving crazy, behaving nastily. I mean, sometimes we do the wrong thing, but we should repent if we do. We should recognize that we're responsible for what we did,
yeah.
And we should repent. But, you know, when somebody just behaves erratically and does not forgive and things like that, then I think that they're neglecting certain spiritual duties. Now, sometimes people like that might have a physical problem. I don't know of it. My wife never had a physical problem that was ever diagnosed, and I personally don't believe that there's any proof that there is a physical problem there. I think that pastor you mentioned is probably right in many cases that it could be a demonic thing. It could be something where the enemy has gotten an advantage over somebody. And this doesn't necessarily mean they're demon-possessed, although they might be. Some people are. But even if a person is not demonically possessed, a person has a spiritual life that they're responsible to maintain. And that requires that we believe God, that we obey God, that we forgive other people, that we love other people, that we would be faithful and merciful and all these things. These are obligations that we have as human beings. They're spiritual obligations. And if we neglect them, then the devil does get an advantage in our life. And a lot of times that advantage includes us not being able to really break free from certain patterns that he's, you know, that he's stirred up in us.
I told her, because she projects a lot, and this is a common characteristic. Some brothers and sisters that know me from before, you know, being in this relationship, know about my past and know about my situation now. So some of them tell me, you know, just walk away, you know, if she leaves you, because she tends to shut me out, and she's pregnant. And, you know, I tell her, I want everything with you. I acknowledge my, because you see, about this situation, my mistake was that I went back to using in times of frustration. That was my way of escape. Sometimes after marriage, she would deny that she had anything. So it was always like walking around eggshells. And you know, they even arrested her once for domestic violence. And, you know, I bailed her out and, you know, but she doesn't, what I look for, I tell her, look, sweetie, I do acknowledge that I use these times and I'm going to get the help. But honey, I want to help you too, because you see, my family says you need dignity for yourself, you know, because mm-hmm. when she snaps her finger, you run back to her. She's always going to treat you like that.
Brother, let me jump in because I got a feeling this could be a very long story.
Yeah.
Let me ask you, does she profess to be a Christian, a follower of Christ?
She does, and she always says that, like, she's very, we're married, but we're separated. And she says she compartmentalizes her life.
Has she ever seemingly been serious about Jesus, or is it just something she says?
The way we met, I actually invited her to church, and I saw her there like for around 4 months, and then that's when we started talking. I assume, you know,
does she still go to church?
Yes.
Okay. Now, have the pastors gotten involved in counseling with her?
Yes. She says that she has an anger problem, but she's very violent. She, you know, that's the thing, you know. Like, sometimes I'm not allowed. The only way I can be with her is if I submit to the scum of the earth position under her foot. The minute I defend myself or disagree, she shuts me out.
Now, let me get something clear. You're separated now. Did you leave the house, or did she throw you out, or what happened?
She went and told people with this disorder. I've learned a lot ever since I didn't know what was happening. I started going to counseling and because I thought I was going crazy. People with this condition, sometimes they go on distortioning campaigns.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I know that there's a lot you could say about this, and I just, you know, when I ask a question, I need to know the answer quickly so we can move along because we've got other callers.
She left our place.
Okay, she left you.
Yeah.
And she doesn't want to come back?
She says that I need to go and fix myself. She says that all of our problems stem from my drug use, and I've acknowledged that I've used the times, you know, I want to own up to that. But the thing is, because you see, it's even in conversation, we can't function because of the.
Okay. Well, it sounds like there's a lot of issues here. I'm trying to put my finger on one particular thing, but I mean, you start out asking what I think about certain disorders, and then we've got your own conflicts with your marriage and so forth. I don't think that this is the kind of thing that can be settled by a talk show host.
Yeah.
I do think that you and the church need to be working this thing out the best you can. Now, if she won't come back to you, if you do all that you can. Well, first of all, that's the main thing. You need to do all that you can.
Yeah.
You need to make every effort to get off the drugs. Now, what are you doing to get off drugs or to stop using?
You see, we did get the pastors involved, the elders, so I started going to an outpatient treatment. I was staying clean and everything, and I was saying, you know, I told the pastor, look, you guys can – he asked me, can we drug test you? And I told him periodically. He said periodically, and I told him, yeah, you know – just as long as to show you guys, you know, not that using is not a problem, but there's a greater issue at hand here. And I was clean for a couple of months and everything, and she would find excuses to not want to be with me. That's how the way I would feel. Like every angle.
Okay, well, we got to deal first of all with your problem with drugs, since that's what she's pointing to as the issue. Now, if you defeat your problem with drugs.
Yes.
And she still doesn't want to come back to be with you, that'll be a different step in this process. But right now, she's mentioning that your drug use as the issue where she apparently doesn't trust you. Now, I'm not saying she doesn't have problems. She may be as crazy as a loon. But you want to get back together with her, and she's saying it's the drug issue that's bothering her. There may be more.
Yeah.
There may be more than the drug problem. But that's an area where, just for your own walk with God, you need to get over that. You need to make sure you get strong enough that you're not going to be falling into drugs, and that your wife can know that you can be trusted not to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's got to be your whole focus right now. I realize that she's saying things, she's projecting, she's probably making false accusations about you. And all kinds of things. I know, because I've had all those things done about me too. But the thing is that you need to make sure that you're walking with God as you should. And you know, even if you've made mistakes and she will never come back to you and your marriage is destroyed, you still need to keep your own conscience clear before God. You still need to walk with God and walk in the Spirit, so you will not be doing this drug stuff.
Yeah,
that's going to be a problem for you, even if you and she do get back together or don't. You've got to defeat that in your life, and I think you need to go to Christian pastors. It sounds like you are doing that, and let them drug test you periodically and so forth, and make sure that you've got whatever it takes going on to get you to stop falling into that pattern.
Mm-hmm.
And now, once that's been done, there may be more that can be done to restore your marriage. Although, maybe not. Your wife may not be open to you coming back. I don't know what she's like, and I don't know what all the issues are. But you've mentioned that the drugs are an issue with her, and that's the thing that's right on the table right now for you to deal with. And so, I'm going to have to ask you to work on that before we can talk about anything else related to the marriage, although I am concerned about your marriage. It seems like this is a very complex situation.
You know what I've noticed, Steve? Sometimes I think that pastors or they're not very familiar with these type of mental disorders, because it's very, these type of people can, you know, put on an Oscar performance,
mm-hmm.
you know, when when we're in counseling sessions and it's, I don't know.
Yeah, I know it's frustrating, very frustrating. And the main thing is to know that God knows what's really going on.
Yeah.
And no matter what your wife says about you, I've had to come to this many times because I had all kinds of crazy accusations made against me that were just nonsense. And I mean, they just had nothing, no connection with reality. And yet people didn't know who to believe, you know. And so I just had to, this is some years ago now, I just had to entrust my case to God and say, well, God, you know, I can't make people believe the right thing. And I can't make my wife stop saying things that aren't true. So God, you're my fortress, you know, I got to just have trust in you and do the right thing by you.
And I confess, you know, I have been careless with myself because I realize that sometimes I struggle to go to that church because, you know, the other time I went and they were like watching me like a hawk. They were like, oh, he's sitting right next to her because she went and told them that I'm a drug addict in the streets and that she fears for her life when in fact she's the violent one. And, you know, I can't
take the whole story right now. We got my lines full of people who want to talk, and we've been talking for 15 minutes. But I'm not unsympathetic. In fact, I tell you something. It sounds like the mirror image of some of the situations I've been through. I know how frustrating it is.
Do you still come to Salinas?
I do sometimes. I'm not doing the weekly meeting in Salinas right this minute, but
the monthly.
Yeah, I'm hoping to do it monthly.
Oh, okay. Then maybe I'll stop by.
All right. Hey, God bless you, brother. I'm sorry to hear about this situation, but you and God need to get a hold of this drug situation, get it done with, and then all these other problems with your wife, I can't guarantee they'll get better, but they're not going to get better before you do. And you're going to have to earn the trust of those people, too, who know that you're a drug user.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, brother.
Bye-bye.
Sorry about that.
Thanks.
All right. Bye now. Boy, that's a sad thing. Let's talk to Dorothy from Seattle, Washington. Dorothy, welcome to The Narrow Path.
Yeah, hi, Steve. Yeah, I just have a quick question, and then I'll get off the air. I've been looking at the definition of grace, and I really don't understand that. I know it sounds stupid, but if I looked in the dictionary, I've been going through my Bible in the concordance and the subject matter, and so I really don't understand what that means when people say there by grace of God, except for that, there go I. So anyway, I'm going to have you help me explain that.
Hey, Dorothy.
I'm going to get off the air now.
All right. Thank you.
Okay, bye.
Bye now. Well, the word grace, the Greek word for grace is charis, and it means favor. And so when it says Noah found grace in the sight of the Lord, or if I might find grace in your sight, these expressions just mean favor, that God favored them. And yet in the New Testament, it takes on a very deep theological meaning that has a lot of aspects, because grace is seen as sort of a general aspect of God's character, of his generosity and compassion toward unworthy sinners, and how that because he is a God of grace, it is possible to be on good terms with him, even though we are not perfect people, because God's grace allows that if a sinner has repented and confessed his sin to him, that God will forgive and will restore. Now, you mentioned another use of the word grace, which maybe makes things more confusing. When you heard someone say, "There but for the grace of God go I," I was told that that's a phrase that I think D.L. Moody said as he was walking down the street, and he saw a drunk on the street, and another Christian pointed out that drunk to him, and he said, "Yeah, but for the grace of God, there go I." In other words, that I'd be just like him if not for the grace of God. Now, when we talk that way, it doesn't just mean that I am forgiven by the grace of God, but it means I'm different by the grace of God. The grace of God has changed me. You see, the grace of God is that character of God that filled Jesus. It says in John 1, verse 14, it says that the Word was made flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld his glory, the glory as of the only begotten Son of the Father, full of grace and truth. It says that Jesus was full of grace and truth. And then a couple of verses later it says, and of his fullness we have all received, even grace upon grace. And that means that the character of Jesus was such as it was because he was full of grace, and that grace was the character of God. Now, of that grace that filled Jesus, we have received that too, John says. We are filled with his fullness, and we have received grace upon grace. Now, that grace that's given to us isn't merely favor. It's not merely that God says, okay, I'm on your side now. I used to be against you, but now I'm on your side. I'm in favor of you. It is that. But with that favor comes all kinds of tokens of his favor. Just as if you are gracious toward somebody who's in need, you might pour out, a lot of generosity upon them as a token of your grace. When God's grace toward us is seen in the tokens of his generosity that he pours out upon us, including power in our lives to be like him, to live like him, to endure hardship. The Bible talks about how Paul, when he was suffering a terrible affliction and prayed that God would take it away, three times Paul prayed that God would take it away, and God said, my grace is sufficient for you. My strength is made perfect in your weakness. That is, God's grace in that case was God's strength being given to Paul at the time of need. I consider that God's grace in the New Testament is not only speaking about his kindness and his kindly disposition toward us and his favor toward us. I believe it's also a reference in many passages to the tokens of his favor that he gives us, the way that he meets our needs generously of anything we have need of, whether it's money, whether it's strength in a time of trial, or whatever. That that's the grace of God given to us. And it says in 2 Corinthians that God is able to make all grace abound toward you so that you, might abound in all good things and have need of nothing. So God's grace will supply every need, that you'll have all sufficiency in all things, it says. So I consider God's grace to be his favor, but his favor manifested in his provision of sufficiency for us, spiritual as well as material. So grace becomes sort of a cover term for all of God's dealings with us. And that's why you have heard someone say, there, but for the grace of God go I, when they're talking about there's somebody who's in a really bad way, and I'm not in that bad way, but that's just the grace of God that's kept me from being in that condition. That is something every Christian needs to be aware of, and it's just that all the blessings that God gives us are his grace or his graces to us, and that's how that word is used there. The dictionary definition of the word grace, however, just means favor. But as I said, the way that the New Testament writers sometimes use it, it extends to a lot of more palpable or tangible tokens of God's favor, whether it's his strength in trials or whether it's his giving of a gift of grace, which is what the gifts of the Spirit are, to enable us to do something for him that we couldn't otherwise do, or other things like that. So that's how the New Testament uses the word grace, and I don't know if that'll clear things up for you or not, Dorothy. I hope so. Let's talk to Jason from Las Vegas next. Hi, Jason. Jason, you got to turn the radio off there.
Okay,
I'm going to drop Jason's call. He's not there. Let's talk to Craig from Round Rock, Texas. Hi, Craig. Welcome to the Narrow Path.
Hi, Steve.
Hi.
Hey, man, can you kind of elaborate on just the different usages of the term Hades and hell and Gehenna and just throughout Scripture, but mostly the term Hades?
Okay, well,
typically understood.
Okay, Hades is a Greek word that's found in the New Testament, and it's synonymous with Sheol, which is an Old Testament Hebrew word. There are many passages in the Old Testament that use the word Sheol, and some of those passages are quoted by New Testament writers. And when they quote them, they use the word Hades in place of Sheol. So we know that the New Testament writers considered Hades to be the equivalent of Sheol. Now, neither of those are the same thing as Gehenna. Now, all of those words are translated as hell in the King James Bible sometimes. And Sheol in the Old Testament, Hades in the New Testament, is something that is, it's not good to translate that word hell. Perhaps some people feel that Gehenna would be a better term to translate as hell, but although that word just means the Valley of Hinnom. But Hades and Sheol do not refer to the place of eternal judgment of the lost, which is what we normally mean by our English word hell. We're usually thinking of the lake of fire when we talk about hell. But Hades isn't that, and Sheol isn't that. In the Bible, Sheol and Hades are used sometimes to refer simply to the grave, where the dead body is buried. Sometimes they seem to refer to something more than the grave. But in general, Hades and Sheol, which are the same thing, simply refer to where everybody goes when they die. Everybody who is dead in the Old Testament went to Sheol. Everyone who is dead in the New Testament went to Hades. And that's just where the dead are. So in one sense, it is a reference to the grave where the bodies go when they die, where they're buried. But in another sense, it has come, and it did come in later Jewish theology, to mean a conscious place where dead people go. In the years between the Old Testament and the New Testament, the rabbis came up with the idea that Hades was a place not just where the dead go, but where they go to be tormented, or where they go to be to wait for the resurrection. And that is the place of conscious waiting of the dead. And Jesus gave a parable, the story of Lazarus and the rich man, where he seemed to use Hades that way also. So basically, the easiest answer is that Hades and Sheol simply refer to the place where the dead go, whether it's referring to the physical place of their burial or something beyond that in certain contexts.
So it could be like a general term just to describe afterlife in general. Not really necessarily good or bad, but just afterlife in general.
Well, okay, yeah. Now, of course, I believe that when Jesus died and rose again, he changed something for people who believe in him.
Okay.
And I believe that when we die, although our bodies are buried in the grave, and we could say that's Hades if we want to, yet I believe our spirit continues to be alive and is in the presence of God in heaven and is not in Hades. But before the coming of Jesus, it seems that everybody was in Hades when they died.
And the unbelievers now would probably, you think they would just say that they are still there in that holding?
It would seem so. I mean, we have very little information about that in the Bible, but it would seem from what we do have that the unbelievers are still in Hades waiting for the judgment.
Do you go in depth, like even more in depth than any of your teachings online?
Well, have you heard the lecture on the three views of hell?
No, is that on there?
Well, it is, but it's not, I don't think it's at my website. It's at the Digital Ministries website.
Oh, I haven't been that one in a long time.
Okay, you should. Digitalministries.us.
Okay.
And, you know, we have a link to it from our website also.
Okay, sweet.
Yeah, but at digitalministries.us, just follow the links to my name. In the topical lectures, you'll find a two-part lecture called Three Views of Hell, and I do definitely go into the meanings of those words there.
Awesome. All right, man. Thanks, bud. Appreciate it.
Okay, Craig. Thanks for your call.
Bless.
Bye now. All right, let's talk next to Lee from Salinas, California. Lee, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. I have a question. In Jeremiah chapter 24, about two baskets of fig, F-I-G-S. Who are these people? One is very bad and one is very good. And the best one that God just destroyed it, and the good one he take care of it. And I want to know who these people.
Okay, well, you're talking about Jeremiah 24,
right?
Yes. Well, when Jeremiah was alive, the Babylonians had come and taken into captivity some of the people from Jerusalem and from Judea. Now Jeremiah was in Jerusalem, and some of those people had been taken away into captivity in Babylon, but some had not. There were still some Jews who remained in Jerusalem for the time being. Now, Jeremiah predicted that Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, was eventually going to come and take them all away. But at this point, only some of them had been taken away. For example, Daniel and Ezekiel had been taken away into Babylon at this time, but the rest of the Jews had not. But there were some others who had, but they were mostly good Jews who were taken. Now, there were some false prophets in Jerusalem who were saying that God is not going to delivered Jerusalem over to the Babylonians. And they said that those people who had already been taken into Babylon were bad people, and that God had taken them into Babylon because they were bad people, but that the rest of the people in Jerusalem were going to be spared. Now, Jeremiah's message was that the rest of the people are not going to be spared. They're all bad people, and they're all going to go into Babylon. And, in fact, this picture, this vision he had of two baskets of figs, one was very good figs, and the other was very bad figs, so foul they couldn't be eaten. He said that basically the good figs represent those Jews who have already been taken into Babylon. They are good. They're not the bad people, as the false prophets were saying. They're actually the good people. They've been able to go into Babylon early so that they don't have to be there to see the slaughter that's going to come upon Jerusalem later on. So he's saying the bad figs represent the people who are still in Jerusalem. And so you've got the nation of Judah, the people of Jerusalem and Judah, are divided into two groups, good figs and bad figs, good people and bad people. And while the false prophets were saying that it's the bad people who've gone into captivity, in this vision God was saying, no, that's not true. It's the good people. The good figs are the ones who are in captivity. The bad figs are the ones who are still in Jerusalem. That's what his message is.
Okay, thank you very much, Steve. Thank you for all your answer, and I appreciate it. Thank you.
Okay, Lee. Thank you.
Bye.
All right, you're listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. If you'd like to be on the program, you can call me at 1-800-438-5090. It's 1-800-438-5090. I received a letter from a prisoner in Soledad, California. There's a prison there where a number of prisoners listen, and I sometimes get letters from them, and his name is Ralph. It's a long letter. I won't read it, but he basically wanted to take issue with me about some things, and he said he's not able to call in, of course, because he's in prison. So he sent me a letter, and he said, I really don't know where to begin. I'm not sure that you are going to read this letter. I wrote to you once, and you did not answer. I suspect that you are one of those religious judgmental persons who has judged me already simply because of my current abode. Of course, you know nothing about me. Now, I want to just say this. I do get a lot of letters, including letters from prisoners, and I don't answer all the letters. I'd like to, but they stack up. They stack up waiting for me, and then eventually the pile does not go down. I do not answer all my correspondence. I can't. I don't have a secretary, and I don't have a lot of time, and I'm sorry about that. But I do try to answer on the radio if people ask questions. I'll try to do that. Now, he said, there's some problems in my theology, and three of them he wants to bring up. One of them is about Matthew 24. He says that Matthew 24 is not about the destruction of Jerusalem in A.D. 70. He believes it's about the end of the world. Of course, that's one of that's the most popular view of Matthew 24, is that it's talking about a great tribulation at the end of the world. And he says, for example, in Matthew 24:22, he says that Jesus said no flesh would be saved if those days were not shortened. And he says this is talking about nuclear warfare, thermonuclear warfare. So his opinion is that Jesus is saying that if he didn't shorten the days, everyone on earth would be destroyed, and that must refer to modern nuclear warfare. Well, I disagree, of course. I personally think that Jesus is talking about Jerusalem. In fact, he specifically says, when you see these things happen, you who are in Judea, flee to the mountains. In other words, flee out of Jerusalem. That wouldn't do any good if there was a thermonuclear warfare going on that's going to endanger the whole world. When Jesus said, if these days were not shortened, no flesh would survive, he means no flesh within the range that he's talking about. He's talking about a judgment on Judea that came when the Romans came and wiped them out. We know this also when we compare it with the parallel in Luke 21. In Luke 21, the same story is told. And Jesus there says, for then shall be great distress in the land and tribulation on this people. He's talking about things coming on the land of Israel. And so I can see how someone might think that when he says no flesh would survive, that it's talking about something global, But this is a very common expression in the Bible, and it's not always talking about a global situation. For example, on the day of Pentecost, when the Spirit was poured out on the people in Jerusalem, Peter said, this is what Joel predicted when he said, thus saith the Lord, I'll pour out my Spirit on all flesh. Well, pouring out his Spirit on all flesh just meant, in that case, right there in Jerusalem. And so all flesh or no flesh, those expressions have to be taken in context. He says, how many false Christs came before A.D. 70? He quotes Matthew 24:24. There'll be many false Christs. Well, quite a few did, actually, as well as false prophets. He says in Matthew 24:27, he said, read it. No one saw Jesus like a flash of lightning from east to the west. That's true, and I don't believe he came in 70 A.D. in that sense. I think he will in the future. Let's see here. Matthew 24:30, he says, read it. No one saw Jesus coming in the clouds before, during, or around A.D. 70. Well, that's not necessarily true. I mean, Josephus was there during the Jewish War, and he wrote a history of it. And he said that there were signs in the sky, and there were signs in the clouds. He said on one point, people looked up and they saw soldiers in armor running in the clouds. He said there's also a sword, or actually a star, the shape of a sword, hanging over the city for a year. So I think, you know, it's possible people did see something like that. I think Ralph's problem here is he probably doesn't know very much about what happened in 70 AD, as many Christians don't. And he's got quite a few things from Matthew 24. He's saying they didn't happen then. I don't have time to go into all of them. I would say that I would not believe what I do about Matthew 24 if those things had not happened in 70 AD. I'm not making stuff up, and I don't have any interest in deceiving myself. I'd like to know the truth as much as anyone. The fact is, I have studied it, and those things did happen. And therefore, Ralph and I just have a disagreement about that. I guess we're going to have to continue to be in disagreement. His second problem, he says, can you really believe that our great God was not giving us some insight into the concept of Satan in Ezekiel 28 and Isaiah 14? He quotes, I will ascend above the, what's it say here? Heights. Yeah, it's kind of hard to read his writing. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will be like the Most High, unquote. He says, do you actually think a man said that? Well, that particular statement is found in Isaiah 14. It's attributed to a man. It's attributed to a man who's said to be the king of Babylon. And the passage specifically says that he's a man. So do I think a man said that? Well, I don't know if the man said those exact words. But certainly that is what the king of Babylon, that is what the whole city of Babylon claimed. They wanted to ascend above the clouds. So that's how Babylon got started, by building the Tower of Babel. The Tower of Babel was the beginning of Babylon. And it does seem to me like that was their ambition, was to ascend above the clouds. And many kings have said they'll be like God. In fact, the very king of Tyre, in Ezekiel chapter 28, at the beginning of that chapter, it says that he said that he's a god, but he's not. He's a man. So as far as Ezekiel 28 and Isaiah 14 are concerned, these are prophecies that, as near as anyone can tell by looking at them, they're written to human beings, the king of Babylon and the king of Tyre. If they also have some reference to Satan, it's well hidden, because there's no reference in them to Satan that's clear. It's only a tradition that has always applied them to Satan. So, I mean, if you want to follow that tradition, I don't object. It's okay. But I don't see it as a compelling tradition. He had one other problem with my theology he wanted to bring up. He said there was some people in the New Testament times that taught that Jesus was coming during their lifetime. Now, he must be referring here. He says some did think that Jesus' coming was imminent. I think what he's referring to here is that sometime a couple weeks ago, I think it was maybe Sandy or someone called and asked me about the imminent return of Christ. And I said that the imminent return of Christ is the doctrine that Jesus could come back at any moment. I said that that doctrine is not taught in the Scripture, and that there did not appear to be any of the writers of Scripture who believed that Jesus could come back at any moment. Paul himself said that if someone tells you that it is imminent, you should not believe them, because he said that day cannot come unless there's a falling away first and the man of sin is revealed. Jesus also said that that day could not come until the gospel is preached in all the world as a witness to all nations. And there were other things that were predicted to happen, which had not yet happened. So it's obvious the disciples knew very well that what was predicted had to occur first, and therefore they didn't expect the coming of Jesus at any moment. Now, some of them, I think, probably did expect his coming in their lifetime. A person could believe that without believing in any moment return of Christ. They knew that certain things were predicted that had not come true yet, and therefore they had to wait for those before Jesus could come back. But they didn't know how long it would take. And some of them probably did believe that he'd come in their lifetime. But my statements are, what the Bible says. Paul specifically said the falling away has to happen first, and the man of sin has to be revealed first. And it did not happen in Paul's lifetime, as far as we know. Let's talk to Bob from Halsey, Oregon next. Hi, Bob.
Hi. Boy, I sure wish I called earlier.
I wish I'd taken your call earlier. Sorry.
You got great answers to that letter. Your tape on, or your download on being judgmental, recommend it to anybody that's wrestling. You bring out a lot of thoughts there, and I appreciate that. And you have worship at the end. I never heard you sing before, so that was a bonus.
Oh, which lecture is that?
Don't take the music off. it's the one on the judgmental spirit.
Huh. Okay. I don't even remember that lecture, but it must be an old one.
Yeah, and then but I'm listening to one now on the views of hell.
Yeah.
And I was just curious. Do you know of any? Any Anabaptist theologian that has any different view of hell than the Catholic?
There is a book. I don't remember the guy's name. He was not very well known, but he was an Anabaptist who wrote a book on hell. He seemed to be a universal reconciliation advocate, but I wouldn't say he speaks for his denomination, and I don't know that he's a scholar. I know he was an Anabaptist. In something like the Mennonite movement or something, but he seemed to believe in universalism. But that might have been his own private view. I don't know of any Anabaptist scholars that have written on the subject directly.
Okay.
Have you done any research on that?
Very little. Just reading the Bible. I've always had a problem with the Catholic view. And you said I was eager to get this download list. So.
Yeah. Did you? Are you listening to the two-part lecture, Three Views of Hell?
I got it off of Digital Ministries. I'm not really sure if it's two parts.
Okay, that'd be two parts. Okay, yeah, that should explain everything I could tell you right now. I appreciate your call. Wish we had more time. God bless you.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast, and my name is Steve Gregg. We are a listener-supported ministry. If you'd like to help us pay the radio bills, you can write to us at The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 3633. Santa Cruz, California, 95063. I want to remind you there's still a donor that is willing to match all gifts that are designated for the Seattle area, up to $2,000. And there's another donor who's come up with the same kind of offer for another $500. So if anything up to $2,500 that comes in for the Seattle area will be doubled or matched by these donors. Again, the address is The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 3633, Santa Cruz, California, 95063. Our website is thenarrowpath.com. Thenarrowpath.com. I appreciate you joining us today. I hope you become a regular listener if you're not. And feel free to call in whenever you have questions from the Bible or about Christianity. Again, this is Steve Gregg. I hope you'll tune in again tomorrow so we can continue this discussion. God bless you.